The Tudor History and Travel Show is a podcast that brings Tudor history to life by exploring Tudor places and artifacts in the flesh. You will be travelling through time with Sarah Morris, the Tudor Travel Guide, uncovering the stories behind some of the most amazing Tudor locations and objects in the UK. Because when you visit a Tudor building, it is only time and not space which separates you from the past. And now over to your host, Sarah Morris.
Hello, my time travelling friends. It's Sarah, the Tudor Travel Guide here, and I'm back for February's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. Now, I felt my pulse quicken this week because as I was driving back from Hampton Court Palace, I passed a whole carpet of snowdrops. And snowdrops for me can only mean one thing. That is the end or the beginning of the end of winter here in the Northern Hemisphere, and that we have a whole season of Tudor road tripping ahead of us. The question is, where are you looking to go? I hope the Tudor History and Travel Show has been providing you with some inspiration over the winter months, and there are certainly plenty more places for us to see ahead. In fact, I have a full and burgeoning schedule. And I'm looking forward, of course, to bringing those to you. Now, there's not too much housekeeping to go over today. I have had my head down, working, beavering away on creating the membership, which is coming together very, very nicely. I'm hoping to do a soft launch with the membership to a select group of people, hopefully later on in February. And if you are interested in the membership, and I know I haven't released any details yet, but it's got all my best work in there, then you can register your interest. And I will include a link in the description associated with this podcast. At this stage, it is purely registering an interest, and we'll make sure you are among the first to hear when the membership goes live, and maybe even a chance to be amongst that initial launch group who will be getting the best ever deal on the membership in return for hopefully helping me iron out any little wrinkles that are still there. Anyway, I'm really, really excited about that. It's been a huge project and I've been working on it for months, and I'm really looking forward to bringing this to you and launching it to the wider world. Now we can get straight on with today's show. Now, there is, of course, an introduction, and you might want to bear in mind that when I recorded this was last year, and since I recorded this, my virtual summit, 500 Years of Anne Boleyn, has already gone live. So my mention of Dermot McCulloch and my forthcoming summit is, in fact, a little bit out of date. But nevertheless, the inspiration to visit certainly came from Professor McCulloch when I interviewed him about a year ago about, of course, the relationship between Anne Boleyn and Thomas Cromwell. And as you will hear, it was Dermot who urged me to come and investigate the long-lost palace. Well, in fact, it's not quite lost, which is the wonderful thing about it. Although the remains of the palace are now part of a school, so it's not a heritage destination that is open to the public, you can still get to visit it via the Friends of the Old Palace. And in fact, our two guides today are part of the Friends, and they will introduce both the Friends Society and the palace. So I think I should hand over to the two ladies in question and introduce you to the long-lost palace at Croydon. Hello and welcome, dear listeners, to this current episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. Now, today I have travelled from the heart of England, my home in the Cotswolds, to the south of London, and I have come to Croydon. Now, I'm here because earlier this year I was interviewing Professor Dermot McCulloch for my forthcoming virtual summit. and we got talking about some of the magnificent Tudor places in and around London. And Dermot said to me, "Sarah, have you been to Croydon Palace?" "Croydon Palace," I said. I was ashamed to admit I hadn't really even heard of it. But of course, that made me put it on my map. And so I have made this pilgrimage today to Croydon Palace, and I am currently here with two ladies who are part of the Friends of the Old Palace. Mary Moore. Hello, Mary. Welcome.
Hello, Sarah. Welcome. Glad you're here.
Thank you for coming along today and being part one of our two guides. And also Janice Barter. Hello.
Hello. You're very welcome.
Oh, well, thank you, ladies, for inviting us into the heart of what was, I guess, a magnificent building during the Tudor period. Now, you're going to tell us all about its history in a moment. But before we do that, perhaps, Mary, you could tell us a little bit about the Friends. What are the Friends? What do they do?
Well, the Friends were a group founded in 1965, and our aim is to increase knowledge of the palace and also to raise funds, not for the school aspect, but for the buildings aspect, to preserve the historical aspects of it. And we've got about 300 members all over the world, Australia, Canada. We've got about 20 who are more active here, and we run tours of the palace 3 times a year during the school holidays.
And I think they're quite popular because I looked at those online and
they were very popular.
I thought, I'm going to have to actually go and say, can I get a private tour? No, this is wonderful. So you mentioned, actually, it is worthwhile saying that today the palace is a school.
Absolutely, school for girls.
It's a school for girls. So I guess that's why you have to moderate the tours and do them on, you know, it's not open to the public.
No.
Because this is a working school, basically.
Yes, and as we go around, you'll see aspects which prove to you it is very much a working school.
Okay, yeah, and absolutely. Because, dear listeners, we're going to be taking some photos and some bits of video as we go around, and no doubt, as usual, I will put together a show notes page so that you can refer to that page as we're walking around and talking about some of the features that you'll then be able to see in the blog. So do look out for a description, which I will append in the description associated with this podcast. Now, Mary, you mentioned that people join from all over the world.
Yes.
So how can people find out more about you, support you, and perhaps even book to come on a tour with you?
We've got a website, www.friendsofoldpalace.org. We send out a yearly newsletter to our members. I'm afraid you have to pay to join. You can book online. It's my email, marybob1@hotmail.com, or you can phone. All the details are on the website.
That's fantastic. And what is the membership, just for those people who might be interested?
It's £30 for life membership.
For life?
For life,
well,
yes.
That's a bargain, that's what I say. Excellent. So, ladies and gentlemen, again, I'll make sure that I put a link in the description below. Okay, well, I think we should start talking about the history of this place. So, Janice, can you tell us about the early origins of the palace, and who was it a palace for?
Thank you. We are very welcome. There's evidence here of an estate, a manor, belonging to the Archbishops of Canterbury, going back to Saxon times, to the 9th century. It's in Domesday Book, when it belonged to Lanfranc. And so we have evidence of a long history of a manor house and an estate belonging to the Archbishop of Canterbury. Why was it here? It's in a lovely location by the Great North Wood. Very leafy, lots of water, 3 rivers, lots of fish. It's an ideal spot. It comes into its own as the home for the Archbishops of Canterbury when Lambeth gets up and running in the 12th century, because then it's a day's ride from the disease, the dirt, the intrigue of London. And so it becomes a sort of summer palace for the Archbishops of Canterbury.
So, Janice, I'm just going to interrupt you there, because I'm very well aware that the Archbishops of Canterbury had a series of palaces that connected Lambeth to Canterbury. I guess this must have been one of them en route.
It certainly was. From Lambeth, you would come here to Croydon, then you would go to Otford, you would go to Rootham, later you would go to Knowle, then there would be Maidstone, Charing, Canterbury. Day's ride, a nice comfortable journey for the Archbishops and their entourage to get to the Mother Church.
Perfect.
So ideal.
Perfect. But you did say this was particularly the summer palace. So why did it stand out from all of those other places?
I think think there's evidence that the archbishops certainly, as you get later into the medieval and Tudor period, spent a fair bit of the summers here. Now, I think it was a very pleasant spot. Croydon means the Valley of the Crocuses.
I had no idea.
It was a pleasant, beautiful, as it still is, ladies and gentlemen, a very pleasant spot. You have the great north wood around you, so you've got hunting. In the Tudor times, there will be horse racing at Duppas Hill, which is a local landmark, which is something which Elizabeth I loved to come and enjoy.
And did she stay here, by the way?
She stayed here an awful lot.
Okay. Well, maybe we could come back to that when we dive into the building. So thank you for just teasing us a little bit there with the royal visitors. So you've got horse racing, you've got the hunting, you've got rivers. So a goodly air, maybe, the Tudors might say.
A very goodly air. Unfortunately, it wasn't going to last. Henry VIII always, he disliked it. He was about the only ruler in that period who actually disliked coming here because he said it was unhealthy. He didn't like it. Now, actually, as the years went by, he may well have been proved right. Because as Croydon developed at the top of the hill, all the nasty waters and it came running down the hill towards us. Yes. And remember that wood? Lots of charcoal burning, lots of smoke. Always a problem. One of the Elizabethan archbishops actually took a charcoal burner to court, basically for covering the place in smoke. So as the years went by, it became increasingly difficult to make it a pleasant palace. By 1780, the archbishops had had enough and they moved out to Addington Palace and the place was left to become virtually derelict. Different parts of it were sold off for different purposes. There was a ragged school. There was lots of bleaching. Remember the water? Lots of bleaching, lots of calico printing, little factories. Some of the posh rooms were actually rented out to local JPs and vicars. But generally, it did fall into disrepair. And quite frankly, by the second half of the 19th century, it was derelict.
I see. And so we're maybe coming sort of to the end of the story at the beginning, but it actually is quite useful, I think, to have the context and to be able to see the whole picture before we go inside and start kind of looking at some of what remains of the palace. So it became derelict. Then what happened?
What happened is that one of the Oxford movement, the young Duke of Newcastle, who was a great philanthropist, bought it. And he gave it to a new order of Anglican teaching sisters, the Sisters of the Church, led by Mother Emily Akebourne, fascinating group of people. And he gave it to them to turn into a school. They were very interested in education. Well, they took one look at it, took a deep breath and said, oh no, it was such a challenge. But they were not ladies to give up. And they changed their minds. They took it on. Within a couple of weeks, they're organising cake sales, donkey rides, fairs to raise money. They started a school and there were two rooms that they could actually live in at the time. And they literally ran a school and renovated it room by room. And it is their school that we have become part of over the years as the school has developed to become the old palace school of John Whitgift.
Well, thank goodness for that. You know, I think we were talking before we started recording. I think a lot of people are like me. They're like, Croydon Palace? Is that what you find that most people...
Absolutely, no one's heard of it.
I wonder why that is, do you think?
I don't think anyone associates Croydon with having a palace.
Yes, absolutely.
It's also quite hidden down here at the bottom of the hill with the main part of Croydon developing the top of the hill. There used to be lots of trees around it as well in the olden days. So again, it would have been quite hidden, I think, as well, which it still is to some extent.
So because today it's surrounded by suburbia, so it's we don't still have the open fields and the clear woodland, etc. So it is very much part of a suburb of South London. Is that how you'd call Croydon?
I think so, yes.
Yeah. So, and of course it's not open to the public, so I guess that's another reason why it's perhaps not got the profile that it absolutely deserves. Why do you think Dermot McCulloch loves this place so much? What would you say?
I think from the day I started working here, I taught history here for over 10 years, I think I was overwhelmed by the sheer presence, the sheer historical presence of the place, the beauty of the place. It does feel like living history. May I say as well, it's a joy to have the children in the school because it makes it alive. Mm. As well as being a wonderful historic building, it is also a working, living, breathing building. And it's that combination that I find quite exciting.
Yeah, and of course, you know, that's what it was meant to be.
Yes.
So it still has that life about it. Now, those folk who are listening may notice a distinct lack of sounds of children around, and that's because it's the summer holidays at the moment that we're recording, so we have the place to ourselves. Now, we're going to go inside soon and start to explore the Tudor remains of the building. But from the outside, maybe you could describe to us, because there's two courtyards, I think, isn't there, where you can get some really lovely outdoor views of the palace. We are starting in the north courtyard. So can you just explain and describe what we can see?
In the north courtyard, you can actually see virtually the whole history of the palace, because you have in front of you an entrance hall to the banqueting hall, which dates back to the 1390s, with a lovely change in land level to show you how that's altered. Then you have the 15th century banqueting hall, again in front of you, linked up with some interesting buildings, possibly Tudor, before you come around to seeing the building chapel, which was built in 1450s, 1460s, but altered and extended in the Tudor period. And that chapel again is quite interesting because the wall outside it, as well as the chapel wall itself, has got some of the earliest brickwork in England to have a look at.
Oh wow, well I can't wait to see that. So we're going from 1390s,
yes,
through to the Tudor period, basically. So 150, 200 years or so of architecture on view. That's fantastic. Now, remind me, I think I recall seeing online a kind of a mid-18th century sketch of what was left of the palace buildings. Do we know what the original palace building looked like? How many ranges there were, how many courtyards there were, etc.?
I think this is very difficult. We have a number of sketches and pictures, and it is actually quite difficult to piece together the information. And we are certainly working on this room by room, but to get the overall picture, I think, is a challenge.
Mm, absolutely.
Yeah, so so there's no, as far as you know, no original kind of floor plan drawing, which is very common, actually, I have to say, particularly of sort of the very early buildings. Yeah. Sometimes the later Elizabethan buildings, I find, have nice floor plans, but that's not so much for the early palaces.
Too many extensions. There are quite a number of extensions, mostly Tudor extensions, which actually have changed that. So that's, I think, part of the problem there.
Yeah. But I will nevertheless, ladies and gentlemen, if you're listening, I will put a picture of one of those kind of 18th century sketches so you can see, I think, one of the earliest views of what the palace would have looked like. Okay, so that's in the north courtyard. So maybe we should just, before we go inside, I'm teasing everybody, I keep saying before we go inside, maybe we should just have a wander through into the south courtyard. That was a guess. And just have a look at what we can see there. So Janice, here we are, a completely different view and a rather charming, I have to say, kind of timber framed porch. Oh, I love that. That's so cute. Anyway, what are we seeing here?
You're seeing again another view of the banqueting hall from the 15th century, but next to it you have a lovely view of one of the great Tudor extensions. So you can see a room which is called Queen Elizabeth's Room, which is an early extension, a Tudor extension, possibly sort of early 16th century in front of you. And next to it, you're seeing the outside of the Tudor Long Gallery, the extension that was built. Now, the wood has now been dated, so we can now date the wood that was used in that to 1538. Wood, as you know, was used always roughly as soon as it was cut. Mm. So that, again, you have a Tudor extension, a long gallery.
And I can see the diapering pattern, those lovely red bricks, the diapering pattern that just tells you that that's what you're dealing with here.
Yeah, absolutely. Windows, doors were put in by the 18th century archbishop. So you have some lovely 18th century windows, and the brickwork was renovated then as well. Mm. Underneath the gallery, you have a series of rather nice rooms, which would have been originally for storage, but became quite charming rooms that were rented out when the palace was being used for industrial purposes. Mm. The black and white oratory building at the end that you can see is in fact 19th century.
Is it? You see, I just said that looks so charming and you've caught me out. Look, that's a 19th century. They did a good job with that, I have to say. Do you think they salvaged anything from the palace, or do you think it was literally built with just materials brought in?
We've got no evidence of reusing for that bit. We have evidence of reusing materials in other parts of the palace, but not there.
Not that bit. Okay, that's great. Right, so what are the different areas that you have inside that you'd like to go and show us, and where might we go first, Janice?
I think start with the Great Hall, which is where we always start our tours. Yes.
Okay, the Great Hall sounds like a good place to me. So, shall we go inside?
Yes.
Excellent. Well, wow. What can I say? We've come into the Great Hall, and what a great hall it is. I had no idea that this existed. I'm grinning from ear to ear, of course. It's magnificent, isn't it? So Janice, maybe you could tell us about what we can see in here, and because there are some fantastic architectural features, aren't there?
There certainly are. This is the Great Hall of the manor, of the estate. It's not the original. There was one here in the 1390s, which we still have the entrance hall and possibly a door frame. This hall we are standing in was rebuilt in roughly 1450 by Archbishop Stafford to welcome a visit from King Henry VI, who was in the area dealing with the aftermaths of a rising.
And can I just say, you're just pointing towards a stone-carved coat of arms. I can see two angels holding up what looks to me like a royal coat of arms surmounted by a crown. Is that Henry VI, did you say?
That is the coat of arms of Henry VI. Underneath it, you see the coat of arms of Archbishop Stafford, making sure he's kept in the picture. And around the lovely Great Hall, you will see a number of coat of arms of either royal visitors connected with Henry VI or indeed Archbishops of Canterbury. This is a classic Great Hall for entertaining, for a variety of public events. It's got a magnificent oak arch-braced roof, supported by buttresses outside. It's got windows. The glass is not original, but the actual window frames are. The ones on the north, possibly from the 1390s, possibly the ones on the south from the 1450s. And you've got the heraldry going around underneath those windows.
Can you point out, because as you said, there are coats of arms just sort of running around both the north and south walls, between the windows. I can see lots of royal coats of arms. Can you point a couple out to us?
We've got Ralph Cromwell, treasurer to Henry VI.
Ah, yes.
We've got Henry Stafford, Duke of Buckingham. Now, the name Stafford suggests that he was related to Archbishop Stafford. He probably wasn't, but it's worth putting up there. There's a fabulous coat of arms there, which probably belongs to Richard, Duke of York, or it may be Edward of Westminster. It's got the classic mark of the Prince of Wales. So again, that one, but again, all linked with Henry VI. The other badges are all of the archbishops. So you will see the badge of Canterbury on one side and the family badge of the archbishops on the other. The badge over here is quite rare and quite famous because it's the wrong way round. You've got the badge of Stafford when he was Archbishop of Bath and Wells and his family badge. And again, it's inverted. So again, it has caused quite a bit of interest amongst the heraldry society.
Do we know why?
No.
There's lots of room for debate then on that point, I would imagine.
Rather a joy to think about it, isn't it, really?
Oh, that's fantastic. So who do we know was received in this hall? You've talked already, I imagine, about Henry VI being here. Who else?
All of the Tudor monarchs came here.
Did they?
Yes, we have evidence, I think, of all of the Tudors. Later kings as well would visit. Charles I was here, I do know that. I think George III was here. Again, most monarchs would have popped in at some point. The Archbishops of Canterbury were such important people that they were visited. And so this would have been a welcoming place for many of the kings and queens.
And they still visit. They still visit. Queen Elizabeth's been here a couple of times. Princess Royal was the last one a couple of years ago.
Wow, so it's got such a long history of royal patronage. But, you know, you were saying before, it's a summer palace, the Archbishop of Canterbury retreating here for the summer. Well, why wouldn't the Tudor monarch, who may well be passing through, because, of course, they had palaces. I don't know how close the likes of Woking Palace are, for example, but you can imagine them progressing around and coming for a little bit of hospitality with their Archbishop. Is there anything else we need to know about this glorious building, Janice?
I think perhaps I could just mention that the wall in front of us, which is the east wall there, actually fell down. That has been rebuilt because it fell down during the industrial decline and has been rebuilt.
Ah, I see. So it really was salvaged. This was a space salvaged. that was salvaged.
The roof itself was damaged in the war, flying bombs. But again, has been repaired and renovated.
Yeah, and you've got lovely, I notice, a fantastic door at what I imagine is the high end of the hall.
Yes. So
that would have gone led into towards the Archbishop's maybe presence chamber and then on into his kind of private chambers, I imagine.
Yes. One point to mention is that the palace would originally have been separate buildings, and you've got rather wet going from one to t'other. But gradually, often by the Tudors, they were joined up and built over. So you'll be going out here into what is now a stone hall, which originally would have been opened, and then into the Archbishop's Retiring room.
So is that where we need to go next?
I think so.
Okay, let's go.
Come up this delightful Jacobean staircase. You see, this stone hall would have been sort of built in.
By lots of lovely creaky floorboards, which are fantastic. So we've left the Great Hall, we've come out through the doorway that we've just been talking about, the high end of the hall, lovely carved, elaborate surrounds, up a flight of steps and into, where are we now?
This is the guard room, a retiring room for the archbishops to take one step back from the public world of the Great Hall. The room that we're in at the moment slightly predates the Great Hall. It will go back to roughly 1400, and it was built by Archbishop Arundel, Archbishop to Henry IV. It's again a beautiful room, an oak ceiling, with again resting on angel corbels holding up the ceiling, with the heraldry of Archbishop Arundel up there as well. It's got a lovely oriel window, which would have been very sunny before the extensions were built. This window was in fact rebuilt exactly, hopefully exactly as it was, in 1900, 1910, by the Sisters of the Church, who were so busy renovating the palace room by room. It is now the school library. So again, very much a beautiful building, a room that is used a lot.
Yeah. So I'm imagining as this retiring room, this is where favoured guests would be brought, and there would be chance to have private discussions, audiences, etc., with the Archbishop.
Absolutely.
Away
right.
from the public glare of the rest of the household. But it's like a mini Great Hall, really, isn't it? Now, just to say that we can't have photos in this particular room for various reasons, so we're not going to be able to show those on the show notes page, but it is very much, it's like the Great Hall, but slightly in miniature, really, isn't it? So a very splendid room for a retiring chamber.
Yes, I think this is still a case of showing grandeur. Here, the Archbishop would have met important people. James I, the King of Scotland, was kept as a hostage in England for a long time and spent a short time here at the palace. Catherine of Aragon spent some time here while she was a young widow. So there would have been important people here in this room.
Oh, that's very interesting. There'd be a lot of people who'd be very interested to know that, particularly that latter fact. And so again, I mean, knowing what I know of the normal flow of a building, we would be leaving this room en route and we'd be going deeper into the heart of the Archbishop's private lodgings.
Absolutely.
So where do we go?
Come with us.
Lead on.
Into a
really fantastic, creaky floorboards.
Yes, a real Tudor room now.
Oh, is it? Look at the ceiling.
The fireplace.
Oh, yes. Yes, I can see. So, still part of the library today. We're surrounded by books, but you can see the room's got much smaller, hasn't it?
Yes. This is an extension built by Archbishop Morton, the first Tudor Archbishop. This is his dining room. So, you had a lovely Tudor ceiling.
Yes, you do.
You have a Tudor fireplace. Panelling a little later, possibly, we're not quite sure of the dating of the panelling, but certainly Morton could relax here and have his supper. So the first Tudor Archbishop. It's got a lovely, lovely wall which leads onto church land, and people are always interested in the fact that it's a very strange slope.
Yes, it's a very odd angle,
it's
isn't
odd
it?
Angle.
It's not a square room by any stretch of the imagination.
The reason being, everybody who has builders will know about this, that Morton built right up to the boundary. That is the boundary with the church, and he made sure that he used every inch that he could. So it was Morton, and indeed it was Morton who also probably joined up the Great Hall with the guard room and this room so he wouldn't get wet. So basically he built beautiful Tudor rooms and linkways.
I see. Now, I might be wrong here, but was Archbishop Morton the guy who was responsible for a lot of building at Knowle? I'm trying to remember.
I believe he did a lot of building everywhere, yeah. Lambeth as well.
Okay, so yes. He was one of those very industrious archbishops,
yes.
Who certainly left his architectural fingerprints all over the place.
Yes.
Wonderful, fantastic. So while we're pausing in here, I was just musing on, how do we know who was here? What are the sources that you still have left that tell us about the history of this place?
We are quite limited with original sources. There's a wonderful book in the 18th century written by the keeper of the library up at Lambeth, which really helps us. And using the papers of the stewards and the records and details of the palace. The steward can be very, very useful. There's a wonderful comment by one of the stewards, I think in 1570s, when Elizabeth is deciding to come for a second time, having just been the year before. And you can almost hear the plaintive cry in his voice saying, oh no, not again, I haven't got enough rooms for all the ladies in waiting, please don't let them come again. No choice. If the Queen's going to come, the Queen's going to come.
It's funny, we hear that story quite a lot as we go around, different sort of owners of these great houses going, oh God, how can we dissuade her not to come? Stories of the plague and of all sorts of things that people make up. Oh, poor Elizabeth. Anyway, so where are those stewards' records kept? Are they at Lambeth with the rest of the Archbishop's papers?
I think, again, we are still researching, doing a lot of work here. I think a lot of information is at Lambeth, yes.
Yeah. Okay, great. All right, so where do we go from here?
We are now going to stay with Morton,
yes.
Because he also built the next linkway.
There's all sorts of doors, aren't there? Just sort of, I'm so excited, I don't know what's coming next.
Mm-hmm.
looks amazing. We're in a dark corridor. It's panelled with oak. Some of that oak looks very old indeed. But now into a much, much brighter and much smaller room. It's so typical. I love the ways we're seeing the flow from the great hall to now in a very, very intimate little space.
You've basically come into a link way, linking Archbishop's dining room with chapel.
Yes.
There is some original glass, possibly the only original glass in the palace up there, with a little bit of graffiti on it saying next the chapel. So obviously when they wanted to put it in, they scribbled it on
so they knew. And do we think that's original graffiti or has that been added later when it's been replaced?
Probably original.
Yeah.
Probably
original. Wow, that's amazing. Can I see it? Where is it?
Top left diamond.
Oh, I see, yeah.
Next to chapel.
Next to chapel. Fantastic. Good. And yeah, I mean, that makes sense. So the Archbishop would have processed across here through this room from his dining chamber to the chapel to hear service.
You also have come past a staircase, which is a Jacobean staircase, but there would have been one there, which would have, you could have gone up there into upper chapel, which we can see when we go through.
Oh, fantastic. And I can hear music, so somebody must be playing. Come in through another door, yet another glorious surprise awaits, because we've come into the antechapel, obviously part of the chapel, and wow, what a building, look at that. I think I actually prefer this roof to the one in the Great Hall, actually. Tell us about it, Janice.
We are still in Morton's extension. As well as his dining room and his link way through, he would have built this extension to the chapel. So antechapel, we are also able to enjoy this wonderful screen that he put across, Morton's screen. How do we know it's Morton's screen? He put his name on it in a kind of joke. As well as the vines that are often in wood at this time, you have a barrel up there, a ton. Uh-huh. It's a rebus on his name. Presumably there may have been other letters around it. Morton. It's a rebus he used a lot. He used it on his cloaks as well. So we're pretty sure that this is Morton's screen. It's also got some lovely figures carved just the other side of it, which I can show you. Two gentlemen's heads.
Oh, yes.
Again. Classic for that late 15th century, early 16th century fashion, which helps us to date Morton's screen.
They are magnificent, aren't they? I mean, not only showing the fashion of the period, the hairstyles and the headwear, but the quality of the carving is just exquisite. You can tell it's really high quality. So fabulous oak screen.
Yes. Dated
to the end of the 15th century, beginning?
Yes, Morton's time was his.
Yeah. And tell me about the roof.
Now,
Janice.
Again, he would have linked up his chapel with the chapel that was already here, which was built about in the 1450s by Archbishop Bouchier, who was at Knowle, obviously.
Yes.
Now, the ceiling has been restored, renovated, possibly 17th century. A lot of the woodwork in here, looking at the pews and the ends, have been renovated in the 17th century by Archbishop Juxon. So basically you have got again, 15th century chapel with a late 15th century extension and the woodwork that's possibly been renovated after that.
And would it all have been painted? Because I can see remnants of paint around. Would it have been, do we know?
We don't know. I don't think we know. I assume so, because so often was it not? You can see Juxon's badge on the roof, which helps you to do the dating. So you've got Juxon's badge, which helps us. Juxon was the Archbishop after the Restoration.
And so. I was reading, I think, some time ago, was this damaged, this chapel? Or maybe I'm getting it confused with Lambeth.
Damage, well, it depends how far you wish to go back. In the Civil War, there are all sorts of rumours and propaganda that the parliamentary forces stayed with their horses and had a kitchen up here. Extremely unlikely. We're on the first floor apart from everything else. So there was damage then. And of course, as I said, the woodwork had to be redone in the 17th century. The glass is not original. We have almost no original glass, which has been destroyed. The roof, I think, did not get hit. The palace was hit in the Second World War quite a lot. I think this roof was all right, as far as I'm aware.
Wow, so any notable events in here that we know of?
Again, this particular room links up, I think, with the history of England very closely. We have a royal pew at the back, which is the children always call Queen Elizabeth's pew. It is in fact Lord's pew. 17th century wood, a pew which looks down into the chapel.
So it's raised, you actually have to go up a flight of stairs, yes. And it sits high up, as was often the case with a privy gallery, I think would be the right word.
Absolutely, yes. And the stairs for it would have been the ones we walked past in the walkway, they would not have been those there. So it would have been quite separate. So Lord was the Archbishop of Canterbury for Charles I. Lord and Charles I enjoyed the beauty of holiness, and they wanted to make the church more beautiful, to become closer to God. Hence, a lot of work was done in this chapel, Lord's Chapel, to make it more beautiful. Unfortunately, there were hints that they made it look Catholic. They were not Catholic, but it made it look so. Mm-hmm. So may I give you an example? For example, this lovely altar rail was put in by Lord to keep the altar separate from the worshippers, as it were. When Lord was put on trial in the Civil War, they found the carpenter who had actually made a crucifix for the chapel here, and it was part of the evidence used against Lord.
Wow, did he come to a sticky end?
He certainly did, yes. He
beheaded?
He was executed.
Oh, gosh. So, thinking about that, I know Thomas Becket was unofficially put to death, but was Lord the only archbishop that was executed?
We have five.
Really?
We have one Alfred.
No idea.
Alfred, who died at the hands of the Vikings. Oh. We have Becket, of course. Sudbury was killed in the Peasants' Revolt.
So that's mid-1300s.
Yes, 1381. And then, of course, Cranmer.
Of course! How could I forget? Oh my goodness. We've only done a whole video of that at Oxford, at the site in which Cranmer was burnt. Oh dear. Anyway, there you go. I know what you mean about the kind of the Catholic feel to it. It's quite heavy, isn't it?
Yeah, but do remember that this was renovated by the Sisters of the Church, who were very high church, Oxford movement.
I see.
So very high Anglican. So the reredos, the altar, the window above the altar, very much reminiscent of that feel,
yes.
That high church feel.
I get it. So I can see each of the windows has some lovely glazing. And I think, Janet, you were saying it's not original, but when were they put in and what's the different pictures that we can see?
When the nuns took over the place, they begged, borrowed and didn't steal whatever they wanted. They asked the glaziers company for some glass. So the glaziers company put in some of the glass. And this is their coat of arms. It's not the original because the glazier's coat of arms has two naked boys on it. You can see that one in the Temple Church in London. Uh-huh. But they decided that two naked boys wasn't suitable for a girls' school, hence the blue skirts.
So they have covered them up. Yes,
indeed.
Absolutely.
Indeed.
Brilliant. Now I can see outside the window what looks like another church. What is that?
That's the Minster. That's Croydon Minster, which is the
parish church.
The parish church of Croydon.
Directly, was it ever connected to Croydon Palace, or was it always a separate building?
It's always been a separate building, as a separate establishment. There would have obviously been very close links, but the two were quite separate.
Right, okay. But I think I was reading that some archbishops are buried in there, is that right?
Yes.
So if you do come here to Croydon Palace, I highly recommend that you knit next door, which is what we're going to be doing after we finish, because there are, Mary, you were saying six archbishops buried over
there. Yes.
Okay, so that's not to be missed. So one of the things you notice when you come into the ante-chapel straight away, it caught my eye, was a very kind of gnarled, slightly weathered font. What's the age of this and what's its story?
This is a Tudor font. We've talked about the sisters lovingly restoring room by room, and they asked for any gifts that they could be given to help develop the buildings. And they were given this Tudor font by St George's Church, Southwark. So not historical, but rather nice to know that this is the font where, had she actually existed, Charles Dickens had Little Dorrit christened.
Oh, is that right? Oh, that's a nice story. Thank you for that. Cool. Yeah, excellent. Oh. Come outside now so we can see we're basically looking at the outside of the chapel. Lovely Tudor doorways, fabulous red brick diapering pattern, all as it should be, I'm pleased to say. Right, are we must be coming back to where we started our tour now. Have we nearly finished? Where are we up to, Janice?
We're now back into North Court, having come through a circuit tracing the journey of the Archbishop from his Great Hall to his chapel. What we can do now is go back inside and have a look at the relaxing rooms and bedrooms.
Oh yes, please. I must say, I do love that flow. I do love the fact that you can go from the Great Hall through these sequence of chambers. I think it's such a lovely way to realise how these palaces and how these houses were used. So it's great, great from that point of view.
Indeed.
Do you tend to find your tours get completely booked up? I mean, they seem to be when I looked at them online.
Yes, we're post-pandemic here, you see, so I'm getting to, yeah. So it's all, I think it's all changed a little bit in that we didn't used to take bookings. We used to have first come, first served. So
right.
You could book, but we now take bookings. It makes it so much easier to organise.
Yeah, right.
We limit the numbers a bit
and
as well.
And we have to limit the numbers to people.
Yes, so we're basically coming through a series of a couple of rooms, panelled rooms, Georgian windows, but very much Tudor. I can see what looks to me like Tudor beams on the ceiling. So where are we now? You said we've come into the bedrooms?
We've come, again, from the Great Hall, up a staircase, into probably the original solar of the Archbishop's. Probably. Mm. So we have a room which is now called panelled, which may have been the original solar, and we've stepped through that and we are in the first of the extensions as Archbishop probably Wareham extended the solar to create a big bedroom. And so this would be an early Tudor extension, the best bedroom known to the children, known as Queen Elizabeth's room, QER, because Queen Elizabeth did stay at Old Palace on a number of occasions.
And so this would have been part of the palace that would have been set aside for her use because there were some of the high status rooms in the house.
Indeed.
Right?
Indeed. So you have got lovely 18th century windows, you had a Tudor ceiling.
Yeah.
You've got a rather strange powder room in the corner. We always call it the powder room.
Little closet, maybe.
A little closet.
Back in the day, maybe.
Yes. We are short of bedrooms here. We aren't aware where they all were. And there certainly was a bit of squabbles between some of Elizabeth's courtiers for who got the best rooms. I mean, there would have been, the other side of the courtyard, which is no longer in existence, there would have been a whole load of lodgings and sort of stabling rooms and all sorts of things. But I think we are relatively limited on the best bedrooms, as it were.
Mm. So. And do we know, I asked you earlier about the layout, but and you know, you said that we don't know the detail. Do we know if it was a single courtyard house or a double courtyard house, i.e. the outer courtyard then into a more privy inner courtyard?
I don't think that would apply because it's been built so sort of haphazardly. It wasn't built as a building, with a classic Elizabethan building. It wouldn't have been done like that.
Yeah.
There would have been a courtyard surrounded by rooms to the north side.
Right.
But I think it was basically very much haphazard.
Yeah, okay. And how many people do you get on your tours? How many do you limit them to?
Well, we limit them to about sort of 25 each tour, two tours, so 50 probably.
Okay. Oh, lovely. We've come into such a light, airy room, and it's unmistakably a long gallery. Can you tell us about it, Mary?
Well, it has only been a long gallery in this state for about 4 or 5 years. Before that, it was two classrooms.
Ah, I see. So you had it opened up. Fantastic.
Well, the Whitgift Foundation paid to open it up, and there was some new panelling put in, and everything opened up. And it is wonderful to have a new gallery, a proper long gallery, in a Tudor house.
It is. And is the panelling, does that date from the Tudor period, or is that from later or salvaged from somewhere?
The panelling, some of it we think is Tudor, and a lot of it will be 17th century. A lot of the panelling is 17th century, but there is some original. Windows are 18th century. The floorboards, which are very noisy, are 18th century. This used to be my teaching room, and again, you made a lot of noise walking around this place. So.
Yes, we're all studiously standing very still while we record this, because I think all we're hearing is the creaking of the boards.
Yes.
You've got the fireplaces, keeping obviously the nice long gallery. Is that two or just the one?
We have an original fireplace here, and there's an alcove further up which may have been, we don't know. As you can see, when it was renovated by the Whitgift Foundation, the second half, you can see that panelling, it was obviously new.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, you can certainly see the difference.
Yes.
Well, what a lovely, light and pleasant, airy place to take a stroll if you were a Tudor lady, or a Tudor king, for that matter.
So, of course, this would be been used for dancing, for walking, for recreation in the Tudor period. Elizabeth I danced here. She probably danced with Christopher Hatton. And certainly in 1587, here, she gave him the Seal of England and he became Lord Chancellor.
Is that right? That's a great fact. Excellent. So that's a really historic date,
yes,
that people can pinpoint to Croydon Palace.
Yes.
I love it.
Yes.
I can see her dancing right now.
Yes. the children like to say that she actually made him Lord Chancellor because he was a very good dancer.
Uh-huh.
I probably think that's probably not true.
But maybe not. It's a great story. Yeah. Oh my word. This is a lovely architectural feature here. It looks like an old window frame. Or more. Tell us, what am I looking at?
You are now in the part of the palace that is quite difficult to guide in, because this is the part of the palace that was most damaged during the industrial times. So there would have been a great water wheel, all sorts of damage here.
Crikey.
So a tricky area. What we have in front of us here is a window which we used to think was possibly going back to maybe Doomsday times, maybe Lanfranc's time, but in fact they have worked on quite recently and done some work, and in fact it is a Tudor window.
Okay.
A Tudor window which is being in the process of being restored.
Yeah, and obviously you can clearly see the frame on the outside. What's inside it? Because that looks very odd to me.
Again, work is still being done. We haven't really got a good idea of layout here because of the industrial damage. This may well have been an exterior window. There may have been a room behind it. We just cannot tell.
They did find a chimney in there.
Ah, that's interesting. So they have presumably then a room behind it.
Yes.
So again,
added during the industrial period.
No, it's much older than that. An older chimney.
Oh, I suspect. Yeah.
Oh. Oh.
And we're back to the south front.
Ah, yes.
The courtyard with south front here and a little courtyard here, which would have developed when this Tudor extension, the gallery, was built. So you have your guard room here, your gallery there, creating a courtyard.
Yes.
So it's not sort of, it's not
deliberate. It's kind of generic. It's kind of just happened.
It's just built up organically. Yes,
with possibly it? Link rooms, linking up
cross ranges.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Quite interesting.
Yeah, it's a lovely little hot and sunny courtyard.
Yes,
for sure. Mm. Good. So, does that bring us to the end of our tour?
I think it does. Yes,
yeah,
I think we've come through.
So. Yeah,
the one thing we haven't mentioned, of course, is the Green Lady. I think we have to mention the Green Lady.
Tell me.
How many schools have got their own ghost?
Oh, you've got a ghost.
The school's got a ghost, yes.
Excellent.
So apparently the ghost only appears to the important people on this site, which means the children. So, but if we know nothing about her. I certainly know nothing about her, but we certainly do have the Green Lady.
Tell us a story.
We do not know.
She's obviously green.
We think so. There is actually another story of a Grey Lady as well, I've heard. Where does she roam? Probably in the linkway between dining room and chapel, and at the top of the stairs there as well, by the royal pew, the Archbishop's pew.
And so the children report seeing, or have some people have reported seeing her?
Not in the last 20 years or so, I think.
No,
but certainly before that.
It's before that, yes.
Ah. I love a good ghost story, though. It brings a place to life.
You've got to have one.
Absolutely. Well, that's fantastic. I just want to thank you both very much, Mary and Janice. Thank you so much for showing us around a completely fascinating building that many, many people will not even be aware of. So I do hope, I think you've done a sterling job, both of you, in bringing the history of this place and its existence to a lot more people. And as I said, folks, there'll be links to how to link up with the friends, maybe come on a tour for yourself, see some of the things that we've been talking about. Just make sure that you check out the description associated with this podcast. So thank you very much, ladies, for showing us around today.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for coming. It's been a pleasure.
Well, what an interesting place that was. There were really some of the features were so impressive, including, for example, the Great Hall. I really wasn't expecting it at all. So it was one of those places where I kind of had my socks blown off a little bit. And I hope you get to book on one of their very popular tours and get to see it for yourself. Well, that's all, my friends. To all you patrons out there, I just wanted to say, as ever, thank you so much for sponsoring the show. I will be communicating with all of you a little bit closer to the launch of my new membership, because there will be changes to this program, this patron program here on Podbean. But I will certainly be writing to you and be keeping you informed well ahead of any of those changes. But for now, it's just a massive thank you, as ever, for helping keeping the Tudor History and Travel Show on the road. Well, wherever you are on planet Earth, I hope you have a wonderful February, and I look forward to joining you again for next month's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. If you've loved the show, please take a moment to subscribe, like, and rate this podcast so that we can spread the Tudor love. Until next time, my friends, all that remains for me to say is happy time travelling.